kind of faced with that March 1 deadline, and they'd come in with a grocery sack full of papers and slips and calendars. They'd dump it on my desk, and they'd say, here are my records. Figure out what I owe. Make sure I don't pay a penny more than I have to, and don't charge me more than $25 for all this. You know, as I did these tax returns, I realized how tough it is to make a living as a farmer. It's hard because very little control over your input costs, very little control over what price is paid for whatever it is you grow, very little control over the weather. So it's tough. And then during the course of the 1980s in my state and across the Midwest and in many parts of the country, we faced a farm crisis where a lot of good folks were overextended and they lost their farms. And I represented many of those folks who were being foreclosed on. And I realized that it wasn't just about money, it wasn't just about how you support your family, it was about a way of life. If it was a connection to family history, it was something deeply rooted in these folks. And I grew to have just profound respect for them and felt that it was my responsibility, my duty, when I got in public life to try to figure out ways in which we could make it a little bit easier for folks to make a living. And that led me to believe that we needed to diversify and to create options for people to be able to succeed, that it wasn't just one way of farming that would be the way that everyone would have to follow, that we could create a variety of different ways. So I'm here today, first and foremost, to thank you folks for what you're doing, because you are helping to create that alternative. And also to remind you, to remind your friends and neighbors how important you and those who live, work, and raise their families in rural areas are to the country. You know, I've been traveling around the country, and I've been trying to remind every single person I talk to, particularly those who live in urban centers or suburban areas, those who may not have had much contact with rural America, precisely how much rural America means to all Americans. Now, it's obviously the place of where most of our food is produced. 85% of everything that is consumed in the United States agriculturally is raised in rural America. And that makes us a food secure nation. We really literally don't have to rely on anybody to have enough food to feed our population. That's an enormous national security advantage that people almost never talk about. But as climates change and water resources become scarce and weather conditions become more extreme, I can guarantee you that the capacity to produce your own, the fact that you're not relying on someone else, is an enormous advantage. Now, it's not just food, it's also water. Nearly 80% of the surface drinking water that Americans consume and use in their homes and businesses comes as a result of what happens on private working lands and in forested areas located in rural America, so it's the source of water. And if you really think about it, every time you flip on a light, turn on a stove, or get in your car and start driving away, the fuel, the energy that is produced that allows you to do all that, the vast majority of it, at least that which is produced domestically, the vast majority of it is produced here in rural America. So it's the source of food, water, fuel, and energy. And then when you realize that it represents a small part of our country, 16% of the population, but 40% of the military comes from those small towns, from those ranches, from those farms, you realize that those families are disproportionately sending their children into harm's way to defend this country. You really begin to realize that your life as an American, regardless of where you live, is profoundly connected to rural America. So the first thing that I think is important is for people to understand the importance of rural America. The second thing they have to understand is the important role that the biodiesel industry, the biofuel industry, the renewable energy and fuel industry is playing in helping rural America begin to turn the corner. You all know this, that we confront two major problems in rural America. One is persistent poverty, and two is that we've continued to lose a lot of our sons and daughters to opportunities elsewhere. But this industry is creating a new dynamic. It's raising farm income. We've had record farm income the last couple of years, in large part because of this industry. It's helping to promote job growth at a time when the economy needs as many jobs as possible. This industry alone is responsible for over 64,000 jobs. The renewable energy and fuel industry is responsible for nearly 400,000 jobs, nearly $30 billion of income for families, contributes over $43 billion to the gross domestic product. It's a big deal economically. It provides consumer choice and lower cost gas. And it reduces our reliance on foreign oil. When I became Secretary of Agriculture in 2009, 62% of all the oil that we used in this country was imported. And God knows where it came from. And God knows where the money that we spent went. Today, it's less than 50%. And it's dropping like a rock, in large part because of the advances that this industry has made. And Americans do understand that. A recent study at Texas A&M suggests that Americans see reducing our reliance on foreign oil as a national security imperative. 80% of Americans believe that. So this industry is making us a more secure country. And the most exciting piece of this is that it's not just limited to fuel and energy that you're producing, but because of what you're doing, how you're doing it, how innovative and entrepreneurial you all are, you're beginning to develop new techniques, new technologies, new efficiencies, and new products. And you've given birth to this whole notion of a bio-based economy where it's not just fuel and energy, but it's chemicals, it's fabrics, it's fibers, it's polymers. And with that, you create the possibility of a new American economy, one in which we are no longer locked in our social strata, one in which we actually can get into the middle class if we're struggling financially, or we can get out of the middle class to the upper middle class because we have social mobility, the ability to move up in the economy by working hard and sacrificing, because we're back in the business in America of making and creating and innovating. Your industry is helping to do that. And that's one of the reasons, that you've been successful is why you now find yourself in the crosshairs of a challenging time where people are raising questions and challenges about the industry. And you've got many of them. You've got folks internationally challenging the industry based on the sustainability of the practices that we utilize. You've got folks in this country creating the false notion that somehow in America we're not big enough, strong enough, smart enough, innovative enough to be able to produce enough food to do what we need to do to feed our own people and yet still have some left over to create fuel in these other products. That somehow it's an either-or situation. It's either food or fuel. When you all know, and I know, it's actually fuel and food. We can do it, and have done it, and we'll continue to do it, because we're the most productive farmers in the world. I'm sure it drives you a bit crazy when some environmental groups raise questions about the environmental credentials of this industry. When you know, and I know, that it's better for the air, better for the environment, but yet there are notions out there that this is somehow not sustainable and not assisting the environment. You know, and I know, that we're dealing with an industry that can help contribute to reducing greenhouse gases. We just had a study released yesterday at USDA on the impact of climate change in agriculture. It should come as no surprise that this report, 140-some pages, basically suggested we're going to see more intense weather conditions, more droughts, more floods, more horrific tornadoes and storms, and we're going to see them more frequently, which means that we really have to develop a set of strategies for how we mitigate and adapt to this changing climate. And it's going to be the folks in rural America that are going to figure this out and are figuring it out. And this industry is one of the solutions. You're facing regulatory and litigative challenges, where folks are suggesting that the testing's not strong enough or that the information is not correct and that the renewable fuel standard needs to be changed and it's not reliable and it's not effective, when in fact it's exactly the opposite. That standard is working. It's doing what it's supposed to do. It's helping to create an industry that supports jobs, improves incomes, reduces reliance on foreign oil, and gives consumers choice. It's working. Now, we've got these challenges. And one of the messages that I want to deliver today is to ensure that you leave here understanding the reason why you're being challenged is because you're winning. So you're not losing, you're winning. Trust me, if you were losing, nobody would be paying attention to you. But you're winning. So these challenges are a reflection of the good work you've done over the last 20 years. But there's more work to do in meeting these challenges. And I want to give you a couple of ideas. My view is that this industry needs to, and agriculture generally, needs to flex its muscles a little bit more than it has. I've gotten in a little trouble in the countryside by suggesting that the political relevance of rural America has been diminished. A little tough talk, because we didn't get a farm bill through the process. And my view is that as populations shrink, that means there are fewer people in Congress who understand or represent the rural interests, and it just becomes more difficult to get things done that are specifically designated as rural initiatives. And so I'm suggesting strongly to audiences that we think about extending the reach of agriculture. Let me give you one example. When you walked into these meetings, when you flew from wherever you came from to Las Vegas, probably the last thing on your mind is who the Secretary of the Defense was going to be. You probably maybe picked up the paper and probably read about Chuck Hagel and probably tried to decide, well, does he support Israel, doesn't he, or, you know, the things he said about Iran, or the stuff that's being reported. But that position is really important to your industry. Here's why. You've got a Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, who sees the future. And he sees the future in which America will be competing for defense purposes against other large, well-equipped militaries from Asian countries, specifically China. And he knows that for us to continue to be strong and protected, we're going to have a Navy that is capable of being in many different places, which means it's going to consume a lot of energy to get from here to there. And we have two choices on that energy. We can either produce it at home, or we can buy it from somebody else. Now, if we buy most of it from somebody else, we're going to have to defend that somebody else, because they're our energy source. If we produce it at home, we have an added benefit of not necessarily having to defend others. We also create jobs at home. So Ray's vision, which I share, is that one half of all energy used by the United States Navy will be bio-based. That's a huge amount. And Ray can do that so long as he has a Secretary of Defense who also believes that's a good thing. Because if he doesn't, that Secretary of Defense can say, Ray, I'm sorry, we just can't fund that initiative. We can't support that initiative. There's a higher priority. Agriculture, the biofuel, the biodiesel industry flexing its muscles, saying, you know what? We're going to make sure that Senator Hagel understands and appreciates the importance of this industry to the Defense Department. And we're going to make a relationship and a friendship, and we're going to be supportive. So when he's the Secretary of Defense, he will support Secretary Mabus. And now, all of a sudden, it's not just the biodiesel industry. It's not just agriculture. It's now the Defense Department that wants to know what's going to happen with the RFS and the renewable fuel industry, because they're relying on that industry to create drop-in aviation and marine fuel that will make them less reliant on foreign oil and make us a more secure nation. That's a different equation than one we have today. Secondly, we got to constructively engage, even with folks who may not necessarily agree with us. You know, I think of the environmental groups. There ought to be conversations to make sure that folks understand and appreciate the science as you and I understand it, which is that there are absolute benefits to climate change adaptation and mitigation, absolute benefits to air and water quality emanating from this industry, and that the farmers and producers are engaged in sustainable practices. There isn't that awareness because so many of us in the United States are so disconnected from the folks who raise our food. We just don't understand how it's done. And we need to be told and taught. So one thing I would do if I were this industry is I would be reaching out to the environmental groups. I'd be sitting down with them. I'd be beginning the dialogue. And it might be difficult because at first there may be conflict. But I would work through that. Because if you go to a member of Congress and say, we want to support the RFS because it's good for the biofuel industry and it helps to create jobs, folks are going to say, well, that's kind of self-serving. But if you're there with someone from an environmental group who says, oh, by the way, it's not just beneficial for their industry, Senator, it's also beneficial for the environment and we're supportive of it, that's a different conversation with that senator or representative. And it's not just the folks at national level that you need to talk to. It's important to engage people at the state and local level. You come from a wide variety of states. Every state has senators. Every state has representatives. Every state has governors. Every state has state legislators. You need to engage them in understanding the benefits of this industry to the locale and to the state in which you live, the number of jobs, the gross domestic product that's contributed. And you need the state legislative bodies to come on record as being supportive of this industry. And you need to make sure that those resolutions are then passed out to the congressional offices so that they know the folks back home are watching this issue. And you need to get governors engaged in this. As they come to Washington, D.C. in a couple of weeks as part of the National Governors Association, all 50 governors, 54 governors will be there. They'll have a variety of opportunities to speak to members of Congress. And they ought to be taking with them a message of support for this industry. And you ought to make sure that that happens. It's not just local and state government leaders. It's also the local chamber of commerce person and the economic development person in the county in which your facility is located, because they understand directly the benefit of having the jobs that you've helped to create. They understand and appreciate what happens when farmers have money in their pocket. Those Main Street businesses get supported. And they ought to be engaged in support of this effort. Because if members of Congress begin to hear from someone other than a farmer about the renewable fuel standard and the importance it plays in their community, that will make sure that they hesitate before they say, well, maybe it needs to be amended or maybe it needs to be eliminated. And you need to engage young people. You've got 500,000 young people who are part of a program called FFA. You all know what FFA is. Probably many of you were members of FFA. These kids are great kids, articulate, smart. They want a role. They want to help lead. Let's give them a job. Let's tell them to use their Facebook, their Twitter, their social media outlet to engage in this debate. And let them create the YouTube sensation like the Dodge Ram truck ad that played in the Super Bowl that will be viral and get people talking about this industry. Unleash them. It's their future. It's their rural America. It's their industry. It's their farm. And they're smart. Get them engaged. So why is this important? I'll finish with this. It's first about the ability to maintain your own livelihoods. That's fairly important. It's important for the people that work at your facilities whose jobs depend on it. That's important. But you have the capacity to help redefine, revitalize, and redesign the American economy to a place where it once was, where people really did have a fighting chance of moving into the middle class and moving up from the middle class. You have that capacity. You have the capacity to reignite a new century of innovation and entrepreneurship in this country. You have the ability to respond to the environmental challenge of a generation as climates change. You have the power to not only do all of that, but to reduce our reliance on foreign oil, make us a stronger nation, and still create enough food and fiber to help feed the world. That's an amazing opportunity. That's worth living for. That's worth getting up every day for. That's worth fighting for. So I'm here today to encourage you to understand you're winning. You got to keep fighting. You got to extend the fight because the stakes are extraordinarily high. Your country's future depends on this, in my view. The capacity of folks to be raised in communities where the concept of community and service are alive and well will depend on your ability to make sure this industry grows. It's that important. And that's why I'm here. I firmly believe it. As long as I've got this opportunity, I'm going to use it to advocate for this. Because I think it's right. I think it's good. I think it creates options. And I think it puts us in a position where there won't be another small town lawyer someplace in the future that has to sit and watch somebody in his office literally break down and cry because who they are is being taken away from them. You folks are that important. I hope you appreciate it. Let's get to work. Thank you.
Jeffrey Larson, farmer from West Central Minnesota. Question for you, Senator Vilsack. Is the
Secretary Vilsack, please.
I'm sorry. Secretary Vilsack. Is there a chance, what are the chances of getting a farm bill? I mean, you worked very, very, very hard on it the last four years, actually. We are coming into a planting season within the next 40 days, 50 days. We don't really... Businesses don't run well without knowing where they're going.
Yeah, no.
So I know it's a tough question. I know it's not up to you, but I know there's a lot in this room that are concerned.
Yeah,
Thank you. I'm
glad you asked it. I didn't really want to make it part of my prepared remarks because I wanted to focus on the industry. But first of all, we need a what I like to refer to as a food, farm, and jobs bill, because when you refer to it as a farm bill, you basically are speaking to that small percentage. When you say it's about a food and about jobs, you have a broader net that you're casting in terms of people's interest. We need one because, you know, for the purposes of this group, we need a strong energy title that continues to provide USDA the resources to continue to help build new facilities and help create new opportunities. We obviously need it for the certainty that you as a producer needs to know so that you can be making planning decisions not just this year but in the future, knowing what the five-year program is going to be. So here's where we are. The next couple of weeks is a very important couple of weeks for many reasons, but it also is an important couple of weeks for the farm bill. We are now faced in 2 or 3 weeks with Congress, if it fails to act on the budget and fails to prevent sequester from going into effect, USDA and every other agency of the federal government will have an across-the-board cut applied to virtually every line item of their budget. Just to give you a sense of how that would impact things, let me just take one small piece of my world, food safety. We would probably likely see having to furlough over 6,000 food inspectors for somewhere between 2 and 3 weeks. Now, if you know anything about food inspection and meat processing, you know that that USDA inspector is not in that plant. That plant can't operate. So now we're not just talking about 6,000 plus inspectors, we're talking about several hundred thousand workers. When you shut the plant down, it obviously impacts supply. And it obviously impacts the market. And it will obviously impact food prices. Real, that's just a tiny piece of my life, all right? So just take sequester and just have it go right through every agency of the federal government. It's horrible policy. Why do I raise this issue in the context of a food, farm, and jobs bill? This reason. Some may be tempted to avoid that consequence, the food safety consequence, by finding other pots of money that could be applied towards deficit reduction. Where would you look for money? How about direct payments? Not very many people like direct payments. A lot of folks don't understand them. Pretty much a consensus to get rid of them, so why don't we get rid of them now? Save $48 billion over 10 years. Well, the problem with that is that if you take that direct payment money now for deficit reduction, you leave nothing for the people constructing a food, farm, and jobs bill to be able to use to produce something in lieu of direct payments, because the money will be gone. So if you're talking about some kind of revenue protection program, shallow loss, whatever you want to call it, there's no money for that. No protection program, how are you going to get the votes to pass a food, farm, and jobs bill? So keep your eye on sequester and hope that it doesn't happen for a lot of reasons, and hope that if it doesn't happen, it's because they've made the right set of choices to give agencies longer periods of time to reduce their budgets systematically, thoughtfully, and strategically, as we are doing at USDA. Our budget's been cut by 12.5%, and we've done it through a whole host of things in a very strategic way that really hasn't significantly impacted the services that you all depend on. That's the goal. And it hasn't resulted in me having to furlough or lay someone off, even though our workforce has been reduced by 6,000 people since I became secretary. Now, so let's say we get through this sequester thing. We get into March, and at that point, CBO, Congressional Budget Office, will give us a baseline, a number, that says the farm legislation has to fit within this number. That number is likely to be somewhere in the neighborhood of what it was last year. It might be a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, but pretty much in the same ballpark. In the Senate, you've got Harry Reid, Senator Reid, from this state, who believes this is enough of a priority to say it is our intent in the Senate to get a food, farm, and jobs bill through the process. Good news, because he's made it a priority. It says a lot about Senator Stabenow's leadership of the Ag Committee. She has a different partner to work with now. She worked with Pat Roberts last year. She now has Thad Cochran, who's from the South, Mississippi. Different partner. So the Southern producers were not happy with the bill that was produced in 2012. So there are going to have to be some adjustments, I suspect, to placate the Southern producers a bit more. Fair enough. That probably can be worked through, and I would imagine that they could get their work done, and that much of what they do is going to look a lot like what they did, because you got pretty much the same cast of characters voting on this. Got a few more Democrats, they're probably going to be supportive. That takes you to the House. Pretty much you got the same cast of characters in the House Ag Committee. Oh, they got some new members, they got to teach them about these programs. But at the end of the day, Frank Lucas and Colin Peterson are going to work their magic, and they're going to try to get something through. But the problem is going to be in the House, the dairy issue. It's not the Southern commodity issue, it's the dairy issue, because dairy producers understandably are upset about the current system. There's too much volatility. We've lost nearly half of our producers in the last 10 years. There's got to be greater price stability in the dairy industry. How do you do that? Well, one way you could do it is by saying when milk prices and feed prices get to a point where there's less than a $4 cushion between the two of them, the government would come in and provide some help. Great idea. Except that what will happen in that circumstance is that milk producers will go, well, this is a good deal. We'll just keep producing more milk and keep that price differential, you know, below $4, but still get the federal money. Well, that could break the bank. So you have to have some mechanism that doesn't reward overproduction. They had a mechanism, it was a supply-side management piece, which John Boehner likened to socialism, and didn't like. And he happens to be the Speaker of the House, kind of important guy. So somewhere along the line, they've got to figure out, how do we do this? How do we remove the volatility, create greater stability without breaking the bank? Now, I don't have the answer to that question today, but I'm confident that if people sat in a room long enough and thought hard enough, they'd find a way. Last point. I've said that the political relevance of rural America is waning, and this is a reflection of it. When in the past would you have seen a bill pass through the Senate, through the House Ag Committee, and never get to the floor for a vote? That's why, folks, we have got to wake up and understand we have got to do a little better job of building reliances, being constructively engaged, making a proactive message to our young people to encourage them to participate and to know the opportunities that exist in rural America, and we need to extend our influence a bit by getting involved in things like who the Secretary of the Defense is or who the Secretary of the Treasury is, because they impact our lives. And if we do that, I think we'll create enough friends and alliances and strategic partnerships that we can call on people to help defend things like the RFS or help promote things like a food, farm, and jobs bill. And we can have our urban and suburban friends understand and appreciate that their lives, their constituents' lives, depend to a great extent on the health and vitality of rural America, because that's where their food comes from, that's where their water comes from, that's where their energy comes from, and that's where a lot of the military comes from. And they ought to damn well be interested in making sure that that's a good place to live, work, and raise families. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I'm Mike Haas. I work with USDA. Another thing that has brought a lot of rejuvenation to the rural sector is not only renewable fuels, but recently recovered petroleum fuels. I'm from Pennsylvania. They frack everything that stands still very long. The Dakotas are also being revitalized. I'm wondering if you have seen anything that indicates what I've perceived, that perhaps this is decreasing the emphasis on renewables. I think that might be another threat to it. I appreciate what you said about the report your department issued yesterday, and early on you talked about climate change, but is there and I appreciate the president's executive actions to do what other arms of the government cannot do with regard to environmental awareness, but is there a sense that maybe conversations about climate change have become a third rail and it doesn't resonate too much among the populace? Have you seen anything like this at your level and decisions in response to it? Thank you.
Well, first of all, I think the above energy strategy doesn't necessarily mean that by natural gas being available or by more oil being produced in the United States that we necessarily will see a backward step on renewables, because renewables have other advantages and other reasons. I mean, the whole octane issue on the ethanol side, for example, is a good example of why we're going to continue to have a robust, in my view, a robust renewable energy industry. The jobs that are created, another reason. The income it helps to produce, another reason. In terms of, I've actually forgotten the last part of your question.
Is it the third rail?
Yeah, third rail of climate change. Well, I think it depends on how you talk about it. Okay, we'll just use this group as a sort of a test. Okay, so I'm here today to talk to you about climate change and how your lives are going to be fundamentally changed and different because the world's going to get hotter and you're not going to be able to grow what you grow and you're not going to be able to raise what you raise, and doggone it, you better get cooking and you better understand this is a hell of a problem and you better change your life. So start changing the light bulbs, start changing your utilities, start driving a car, forget the car, start bicycling to work. Or we could say this. You know, agriculture is a risky business. My heavens, how many risks can you name? But one risk is that we don't have any control over Mother Nature. And every year, we try to outsmart Mother Nature, and you know, frankly, we do a pretty good job. We develop new seed technologies, we develop new irrigation systems, we develop new chemicals and pesticides that help us mitigate risk. We got a new risk that we got to think about, which is that the climate's changing and these weather conditions are liable to get more severe. They may be more frequent. We may have drier conditions where we used to have pretty good conditions. We may have wetter conditions in other places. Let's figure out how we adapt to this. What crops will be better raised in this area? What technologies can we use from a seed technology standpoint that will mitigate the fact that we may not have quite as much water? Yeah, what planning decisions do we need to make? Are we really fully utilizing all of our potential? Let's look at the possibility of cover crops and multiple cropping and how that might be different from one part of the country to another, and let's do the research and understand it better. And let's, by the way, figure out markets for all this stuff, because we're just not going to feed it to livestock. We're going to create new chemicals, we're going to create new polymers, we're going to create new fabrics, and we're going to reduce greenhouse gases, because we're going to have ecosystem markets that's based on this new conservation ethic. And, you know, actually, we got a lot of risk management opportunities here. So let's have a conversation about that. I don't know, folks, which one? I mean, that's how I think we have to talk about it. I mean, let's not scare people. There's no reason to scare people. Let's talk about the opportunity side of this. Americans are extraordinary when it comes to challenges. I mean, think about what we've done in the lifetime of the people in this room. I mean, if somebody and I'm 62 years old, somebody had told me when I was born in 1950 that, you know, within your teenage years, we're actually going to land somebody on the moon. Are you crazy? If somebody had told you that you could take this little instrument and have it run your life? Well, it may not be, but think about this thing. I mean, you know, I remember growing up as a kid reading Dick Tracy, and he had the watch, you know, that he could talk to. You know, here it is. It's an amazing country. And we're on the cusp in rural America of having something akin to this, of just basically taking everything we grow on a renewable basis and figuring out a million different things to make from it. And we're far ahead of a lot of people on these technologies. So I think it's not the third rail. I think it's an opportunity. Now, but it does depend on how you talk about it, how you frame it. And I think for those of you who may be going to the Outlook Forum later this month at USDA, we're going to talk about risk management. And part of my remarks are going to be what we are doing and what we're planning on doing at USDA in terms of this particular issue, and how we're going to try to get rural America, USDA, agriculture sort of ahead of this curve as opposed to behind it. Yes, sir.
Don't have a mic, but I'll shout. We all know why the tax credit is a good deal for America, at least unless you're from the API. But it's passed in the wrong way, I think, in the public eye. And I think its days might be numbered. How do you see that we can recast the tax credit to really help Americans understand why it's a good deal for America?
Well, let me say this. Its days are numbered because every kind of subsidy or assistance ought to have its days numbered at some point. I mean, the goal here is to support until you're self-supporting, right? So I don't mean to be flippant about my answer. It's just a matter of when, right? I think the way you talk about it today is that this industry, and I use it sort of in a broad perspective, this industry is not just simply producing a fuel product, but it is producing an incredible amount of innovation. And this industry doesn't have the kind of built-up capacity that a more mature industry has to do a lot of R&D. So the credit basically gives you the flexibility to try some new piece of equipment to see whether or not you can create it more efficiently, or try a different formula to see if it works more effectively, or shoot, you discovered something you didn't realize you were going to discover when you were doing it, and now you want a new company that you want to start. All of that, I think, it's about spurring innovation. So I would couch it in those terms, and then I would give people specific examples of literally hundreds of projects and technologies that have been developed as a result of this industry over the last 20 years, where it started, where it is today, and where you think it will be 5-10 years from now. And a way of making sure that history happens is by supporting the industry and recognizing that at some point in time it's going to be self-sufficient and you want that day to come sooner rather than later. You know, the tendency of these tax credits is that people become they become dependent upon them, and the way they sell them is in sort of a dire, like, my God, if you take this tax credit away, it's the end of the industry. And, you know, members of Congress hear that all the time. So, yeah, I think you have to have a freshness to an argument, and I think the freshness is this whole industry has the chance to change the dynamic in rural America. Just so you all know, I firmly believe there's a new economy being formulated in rural America, and it's got four cornerstones. We've talked about one extensively today, which is the bio-based economy. But the other three are equally important: production, agriculture, and exports. We've had four of the best export years in the history of the country on ag exports. We're going to continue that. That's really important. Local and regional food systems. You know, not everybody can be a big producer. Not everybody can sell, you know, on a market that is for larger producers competitively. Why not create the ability to sell locally to a school, to a farmer's market, community support agriculture? A lot of entrepreneurship, a lot of innovation, a lot of young people getting into that space. They're repopulating rural communities. They're bringing new energy. That's a good thing. We ought to be supportive of that. And then conservation and outdoor recreation. The president just designated the CEO of REI as the new Interior Secretary, and she will bring to that that agency, if she's confirmed, an understanding that outdoor recreation is a $656 billion industry, and there ought to be a way in which we in rural America can figure out how more of those billions are spent hunting, fishing, biking, and hiking in our rural areas, and those tourism dollars can reverberate around an economy pretty quickly. So we got four cornerstones, which is why we need a food, farm, and jobs bill to support those four cornerstones. And we need the research. We need folks to understand that research, agricultural research, is just as important as healthcare research. And honestly, it hasn't been treated that way. But I think there's a growing recognition in D.C. of the need to, even in tough budget times, to continue to fund important ag research.
Okay, one more question.
Mr. Secretary, Mark Truesdell from Des Moines, Iowa.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm very well. As you observed, we've got the success now from this industry can claim a great deal of success for the new higher levels of corn and soybean prices. And at the same time, we've seen in the last year resistance from, speaking on behalf of the soybean and corn farmers, from our brethren, the cattlemen, poultry producers, et cetera, joining in on the request for the repeal, or the waiver, excuse me, of the RFS-2. Do you have any counsel for us on how to address our brethren in agriculture on this issue that is very vital to us?
Right. What's the saying during the Revolutionary War, something about we either hang together or we'll hang separately? You know, agriculture, if you look at agriculture in terms of population, just the number of people in agriculture, we define it at USDA as anybody who sells more than $1,000 worth of stuff is a farmer. That's a pretty loose definition. And even with that loose definition, only 2.3 million people qualify. So that means it's less than 1% of America's population. And then if you actually talk about the people you're talking about, Mark, who are the people who produce most of what we consume, it's 200,000 to 300,000 people. Now, you got all these challenges from environmental groups, from city folks, from you got all these folks focused on agriculture in a negative way. You got editorials being written, and here you guys are fighting with each other. I got to tell you, you either better hang together or you absolutely are going to hang separately. That's number one. Number two, look, certainly you as a soybean producer or you as a corn producer, can corn farmer can certainly appreciate how tough it is because you lived with $2 corn for a long time, and you struggled. So you understand and appreciate their challenge, but you say to them, you know, let us work with you to figure out ways in which what we produce can help your industry, the DDGs. Let us figure out how to help you with the research that will create greater efficiencies. Let us figure out collectively how we can even grow more than what we're growing on an acre of land, which is incredible. In my lifetime, corn 300% increase, soybeans 200% increase, and we're not finished yet. Let us band together and make sure that that these new technologies are not stifled by those who don't understand them. Let us work together to continue to improve and expand exports so that you continue to have healthy markets for what you grow and raise. And let us also understand that sometimes it's not the feed price that's really creating a problem for you. Sometimes it's the price of oil going up that has an impact. And you ought to be thinking about that. And let's also understand that we should be combining our efforts to figure out new and creative ways to use every piece of a hog or a cattle or chicken. I mean, we're pretty inventive about what we do with all these critters and what's left of them after we've butchered them. But there's still a lot of work that could be done in that area as well. I mean, I found this to be true when I went to Ohio State. I've told this story to a lot of folks, and I mean, it's just amazing. I'm sitting there at Ohio State at their products lab, and they're showing me a bunch of stuff, and it comes to this big chunk of rock in the middle of a table, and I said, "What is this?" It was black rock. They said, "Well, it's asphalt." I said, "Great. I'm the Secretary of Agriculture." Ray LaHood, I don't know where he is today, but he's the Secretary of Transportation. He'd be more interested in this. They said, "Well, we thought you'd be interested in it because the adhesive device for this asphalt is hog manure." I said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah, and we're actually experimenting it with it in roads in southern Ohio, and it's actually wearing pretty well during the winter." Now, I usually say at this point it makes the tires squeal, but I won't. But, you know, I mean, there's an unlimited future here, and I think what happens is this. And there was a great article in the Washington Post this Sunday by a Marine who was regretting the fact that America has become a country fixated on security and stability. And his point was that when you become fixated on security and stability, you let go of what he referred to as your inner go, the capacity to think and to take risks, and understand that there's a whole new brave world out there and that there's just an unlimited future. And I think sometimes that's what happens in agriculture, is that we just sort of start, you know, I'm going to hang on to what I got and hope to heck I can get through the next growing season, or hope to heck I can get through my lifetime and my kids will have to worry about it, as opposed to, good Lord, what an enormous opportunity this is. This is incredible. Everything in an economy can be built and made and produced and processed in my hometown from what I grow. I ought to be all over that. I ought to be for that. That's not competing with livestock. That's expanding opportunity so that the farm of the future is going to be livestock, and it's going to be trees, the carbon sequestration, and outdoor recreation with hunting and fishing opportunities on my farm that I provide access to, and corn that's being converted into fuel, and soybeans that's being converted into a medicine. You know, I mean, just unlimited. And that's the future we should be selling to people. Because if you want, you know, that ad that has a kid at the end with the cowboy hat and he wants to be like his dad, you know what? That kid's smart. He's not going to want to be like his dad if his dad's complaining about how tough this all is. He is going to want to be like his dad if his dad gets off that farm and says, "My God, son, I am so jealous of you because you are so much younger than I am, and there is so much to do, and you can make all the difference in the world. You can feed people. You can mitigate the impacts of climate change. You can make this country stronger. You can reduce our reliance on foreign oil. You can create new products. You can create new businesses, and you can have an extraordinary life in America." You know, so that's what I'd say to livestock guys. Thank you all very much.